On March the 8th, the pilots on board Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 bid a normal goodnight to air traffic control. And that was the last anyone heard from the plane. I'm Melanie Abbott, and in this special programme for the BBC World Service, The Mystery of Flight 370, I'll be asking how it's possible, in this day and age, to know so little about a vanished airliner. There was no Mayday call. It simply disappeared off the radar on its journey from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, as if it fell from the sky without trace. Impossible, of course, but without an explanation, the whole world is fascinated by its fate.
Very little extra information at the moment. We can still see the flight listed on the international arrivals board here at Terminal 3 at Beijing Airport. MH370 listed from Kuala Lumpur, of course, stated time of arrival 06:30 this morning, and the estimated time of arrival slot there now completely blank with the words delayed under the remarks section of that board.
Had there been some catastrophe on board? Was it a hijack, sabotage, or a suicidal pilot? After nearly 4 weeks of investigating and searching, we don't even know where the plane is, let alone what happened.
Day 1, March the 8th.
The Boeing 777 lost contact with air traffic controllers as it passed from Malaysian to Vietnamese airspace. An air and sea search focused, naturally enough, on the plane's flight path over the South China Sea. Relatives of the 239 people on board could do nothing but wait for news.
That morning I had switched on the television. I saw the plane they were saying missing, but it didn't hit me that my sister was on board there.
Bimal Sharma is a merchant sea captain who lives in Delhi in India. His sister Chandrika had left behind her husband, an 18-year-old daughter, to travel from Chennai in India to Mongolia. This was one leg of a three-flight journey. As General Secretary of the International Collective in Support of Fish Workers, she was heading for a United Nations meeting.
Then about 7:15 in the morning on Saturday, my brother-in-law gave me a call, said Chandrika was on that flight. I said, no, I don't believe it. That was shocking. I mean, I broke down at that moment.
Perhaps I can ask you a bit about Chandrika. What kind of a person is she?
She was a social worker, very down to earth, always helpful to others, wanting to do things for others. I remember as a small child, she brought one poster which she liked very much, and the poster said, I asked of life, what can you give? And the answer came back, what can you give to life? So she was always doing things for others, and like she did her master's in social work, and what she was doing now was also social work. She was looking after the welfare of the fishermen of worldwide.
Bimal thought he would hear more within a day or two. His only snippet of information, that the plane last contacted air traffic control 40 minutes into the flight. He watched television avidly over the next few days as it was revealed that two passengers on board were using stolen passports. Could they have hijacked the plane? And if so, where had they taken it?
Day 4, March the 11th.
The Malaysian Air Force says radar information suggests that a passenger airliner that went missing on Saturday changed course and headed west. The last civilian contact put the Malaysia Airlines plane somewhere between Malaysia and Vietnam. But military sources say their radar records show that the plane started to turn round and may have flown right across the Malay Peninsula.
Until now, the search had been concentrated along the planned flight path. This was the first news that, in fact, MH370 made a sharp left turn away from its intended route. Like much of what has emerged over the past 27 days, this raised more questions than it answered. The plane lost contact, passing from Malaysian to Vietnamese airspace, never checking in with the next air traffic control. But it appears no one was worried enough to ask what was happening on MH370 and where it was. MP Khalid Samad has been asking why in the Malaysian Parliament.
The most important element of complacency was on the part of the Department of Civil Aviation, the air traffic controller, because the moment the aircraft went missing, they should have alerted all parties, including the Air Force. And the most logical step would have been for the air traffic controller or the Department of Civil Aviation to immediately inform the Air Force, who are having the radars, to be on the lookout. And I think that was the mistake that was done by the Department of Civil Aviation.
We asked the Department of Civil Aviation if it was a mistake, but were told they couldn't respond to our questions yet. Either the plane was only spotted in retrospect, or the military didn't realise it could be the aircraft way off its course. Nick Childs, a BBC defence specialist, wonders why no action was taken.
Particularly post 9/11, when a military radar operator spots such a contact, you would expect him first to notice it, secondly, to at the very least get in touch with civilian air traffic control. Do they know that there is a, you know, an aircraft in this vicinity? And if so, what is it? If the answer to those questions are no, you would first of all try and hail it by radio. I have an unidentified contact at this location. Please identify yourself. And again, if you get no response, then you would move on ultimately probably to scrambling some fighter jets at the very least to go and have a look and see what's what, and who knows what they would have to do, but they would be there on the scene looking at this aeroplane.
We asked the Malaysian Air Force why they didn't act, but have had no response. If they had reacted, we might be closer to finding out why the plane made that sharp left turn. Was there a fault and the pilot was trying to get to an airport to land? Or was it a hijack and the plane was forcibly diverted? An announcement a week later seemed to add credence to that theory.
Day 8, March the 15th.
We can say with a high degree of certainty that the aircraft communications addressing and reporting system was disabled just before the aircraft reached the east coast of Peninsula Malaysia. Shortly afterwards, near the border between Malaysia and Vietnamese air traffic control, the aircraft transponder was switched off. It then flew in a westerly direction back over Peninsula Malaysia before turning northwest. These movements are consistent with deliberate action by someone on the plane.
The Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak stunned listeners with the use of that word deliberate. It seemed sinister. Was it an attempt to evade radar and take the plane to a secret destination? The Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System, or ACARS, which the Prime Minister referred to, can send and receive short text messages manually. It also transmits automatic messages about the aircraft, for instance, if the engine stalls. The transponder allows radar on the ground to identify the aircraft. Without it, a blip will be seen, but you won't know which plane you're looking at. It can also be used for basic communication, especially in emergencies. I'm now heading into the cockpit of a Boeing aeroplane, but this one is in a flight simulator. I'm heading into the co-pilot seat, and sitting next to me in the pilot seat is Steve Landells from the British Airline Pilots Association. We've got in front of us the steering columns, a vast array of gadgetry here. What kind of things are these?
Well, in the centre you've got the electronic displays of the engine instruments, and each pilot in front of them has a navigation display. And
the transponder is one of the most useful bits of kit on board.
It's, as you see, between us is a box, and it's got various settings, and there's one switch that basically is an on-off switch. So if you want to get stop that sending out information to air traffic control, very simply just turn it to off.
Why would you want to switch it off?
The easy answer to that is you wouldn't.
Why is there an off switch at all then?
Because anything electrical, the pilots need to be able to switch off in the event of a fire. So if, for instance, that little transponder box, it's only 4 inches long, 2 inches high, if any smoke started coming out of that, the first thing you do would turn it off to try and isolate the power to that.
But in the event of an emergency here in the cockpit, like you say, if you saw smoke coming from this central console between us, you would reach for that off switch on the transponder.
If you could identify that the smoke was coming from the transponder, you would want to turn it off. But it's also, it's a really valuable communication tool. So if you have a general emergency and you want assistance quickly, you can very quickly put 7700 into that, and that'll alert air traffic control. Any air traffic control radar that's looking at you, it'll flash up on the screen that you've got an emergency.
Can you think of any situation then, apart from smoke coming from the transponder, where you might need to turn off the ACARS system and the transponder?
No, I can't think of any situation where I would want to do that. It's certainly something I'd never done, and I've never even considered doing it.
The Malaysians seemed convinced the communication systems had been turned off and not just failed. We don't know why they seem so sure. With these systems off, all that was known about the Malaysian airliner's location came from hourly pings transmitted by ACARS. Even switched off, it will still check in with the satellite but gives no more precise location information. In that same day's news conference, on day 8, there was another startling new conclusion.
According to the new data, the last confirmed communication between the plane and the satellite was at 8:11 a.m. Malaysian time on Saturday, 8th of March.
What this meant was the plane had probably flown on for at least another 7 hours after the last human contact. This analysis was based on information from the British company Inmarsat. The families of the 12 crew and 227 passengers waited a week wondering where the plane was to be told these pings appeared to show the plane had travelled several hundred kilometres in one of two directions and, in fact, could be anywhere from the mountains of Kazakhstan to the bottom of the Indian Ocean. But why would it fly on for so long? Were the crew and passengers dead and the plane running on autopilot until the fuel ran out? Was it a hijack attempt or a case of pilot suicide? All theories filling the vacuum of not knowing what has happened to loved ones like Bimal Sharma's sister Chandrika.
My theory is that the aircraft has been hijacked for a ransom or some other deal they want to make. That's my theory. I don't believe you can lose an aircraft like this. Where is the aircraft after it took off? How can it go off the radar? I mean, I'm from the industry. I'm a captain from the Merchant Navy. I know all about radars. And you can have your automatic identification system switched off, yes, but not your that massive body off the radar. It can be diagnosed as an unidentified flying object.
It has to appear in some way, you would have thought.
Yes, yes, yes. It has to appear. And there must have been so many other aircraft who must have traced them on radar who were supposed to flash that there is an unidentified aircraft flying.
Day 13, March the 20th.
The Australian Maritime Safety Authority has received information based on satellite imagery of objects possibly related to the search. Following specialist analysis of this satellite imagery, two possible objects related to the search have been identified.
This revelation by the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott created great excitement. Could this be the remains of MH370 floating in the southern Indian Ocean? We asked Bimal Sharma what he thought.
This is just a debris. It's just, I don't believe that they found it. I mean, it's a satellite image of that area where I'm telling you they have accumulation of garbage. So in my heart of hearts, I just don't believe it.
How important is it now that you get some kind of confirmation either way?
Well, I want confirmation not either way. I want my sister to be back for her birthday. I'm very hopeful.
And that's on the 30th of March, I think you said.
That's correct.
Have you thought about how you will cope if they don't come up with any answers?
I'm waiting for her to come back. That's it. That's my only hope at the moment. And I believe it from the bottom of my heart that she'll come back.
Obviously, Chandrika's birthday has come and gone as the hunt for the aircraft continues. Searchers out at sea are being helped by roughly 6 million volunteers at home who are fascinated by the fate of MH370 and want to do their bit by crowd-searching satellite images posted on the internet by a company called Digital Globe. But it's incredibly difficult to spot anything, as I found when I joined one of the searchers. We're looking at the same map now, you and I, and as we look at it, there are various white
blobs, for want of a better word, that I can see. And there's one in the middle that looks almost like a white cross. So do you think that's anything?
I did. I thought that looked, obviously, is man-made. And I was getting very excited about that. But somebody posted...
There are more than 3,000 square kilometres of images, and it's an arduous task going through them all. Caroline Dobson, sitting at her computer at home in Chester in the north of England, is helping to scour the ocean thousands of kilometres away.
One of the days I was on it for, you know, a good couple of hours, because it's very addictive. You think, I'll just look at one more square. It might be there. And, you know, you find yourself saying, well, just one more. And I've had a couple of late nights looking at it.
Are you hopeful it can really help? Or
you feel very helpless, but you just play a little part in it and think, I might just see that. You know, but yes, it does feel that, you know, it's literally, as I saw a quote today, a needle in a haystack, except we haven't found the haystack yet.
Day 17, March the 24th.
Based on the new analysis, Inmarsat and the AAIB have concluded that MH370 flew along the southern corridor.
The Malaysian Prime Minister, Najib Razak, again appeared before the world's media with a message no one expected.
It's a remote location, far from any possible landing sites. It is therefore with deep sadness and regret that I must inform you that according to this new data, flight MH370 ended in the southern Indian Ocean.
He was surprisingly definitive when he concluded that the plane was indeed lost at sea. Some of the relatives received the news from the authorities by text message. Bimal Sharma, whose sister Chandrika was on board, heard from his brother-in-law. We called Bimal on his mobile shortly afterwards as he was driving home.
There should be a black box. There should be some debris. There should be some remains or something. And I'm sure they're not going to abandon the search, I suppose. And I don't know whether they're going to abandon the search, Melanie.
No, I think they'll be continuing the search to try to find something, especially as there are these reports of more objects there.
I mean, this is like she just disappeared into thin air and that's it. And somebody concludes that the aircraft is gone.
Do you think it would take finding debris for you to actually be convinced that that is what happened, that the plane had crashed into the sea?
Yes, of course. That would be concrete evidence, yes. Here, the whole world of planes are going around and they can't recover a single thing, and then they come to a mathematical conclusion. That's hard to believe.
The Malaysian Prime Minister's announcement was based on further analysis of the satellite pings provided by Inmarsat. Assuming this is correct, it means after the first initial sharp left turn, the plane made a second one to end up in the southern Indian Ocean. In the flight simulator with Steve Landells, who flew Boeing 777s for 11 years, I asked him about this second left turn.
Now, there are only two ways the aircraft can turn, really. That is either pre-programmed route via the autopilot, so that needs some sort of input at some stage, either at the time or before it, or someone manually flying the aircraft. So some input to the controls would have been needed for it to make that second turn, assuming it did make that second turn.
It wouldn't be possible for it to have just drifted off course.
It wouldn't be possible for it to go through that degree of turn just by drifting. It was quite a significant turn.
Day 21, March the 28th.
An international air crash investigation team in Malaysia provided updated advice to the ATSB, which has examined the information and determined an area 1,100 kilometres to the northeast of the existing search area is now the most credible lead as to where debris may be located.
After days of looking in the far south of the Indian Ocean, the hunt moved 1,100 kilometres, not a small distance, So for 8 days, searchers had been in the wrong place. Add that to the difficulties of being in one of the most remote oceans in the world. To get an idea of just how difficult the task is, I went to meet one of the experts in the field, Dr. Simon Boxall, an oceanographer at the University of Southampton.
Now, the first thing you can note from this chart is how little data we have for the seafloor in this area. Actually, we've got a more detailed map of the moon's surface than we do of this area here. And that gives you an idea of how remote this particular part of the world is.
You've got some pictures here of currents in that area. What do we know about the seas and the currents around there?
The currents here are very complex, and that's going to make the search for surface debris even more difficult. The problem is that the ocean is full of rubbish. There are something like 10,000 containers drifting around at the surface of the sea. There is probably debris still from the Indonesian tsunami 10 years ago. So trying to separate out these sightings of debris from the satellite from potential aircraft parts means you've got to be on the sea, picking them up and identifying them in your hand.
The real laborious task then, finding them and then saying, what are they?
That's right. You've got a rough sea. Even if you're within half a kilometre of a piece of wreckage, you may miss it. It's that difficult to spot these things in the sea. So it's still a monumental task.
If the plane is indeed in the Indian Ocean, was it deliberately ditched in such a difficult area to search, making finding the biggest clue to this whole mystery, the black box, a slim possibility? Even when you know where the plane has crashed, it can be hard enough.
French search teams say they found the data recorder from an Air France jet that crashed off the coast of Brazil in 2009 without warning. Robots capable of operating deep below the ocean were used to find the recorder.
This was 2 years after the Air France plane crashed on a flight from Brazil to France. It took that long, even with the advantage of the ACARS system on board, which sent back location coordinates, so the wreckage was found within 5 days. There is new technology which would allow black box information to be streamed live in an emergency. In fact, after the Air France crash, it was recommended that planes should be fitted with this kit. Other recommendations included making the black box batteries last for 90 days, 3 times as long as now, giving you more chance to find it, and using GPS to track an airliner's position. This would allow the location of any wreckage within a 3-mile radius of a crash. 5 years after the accident, none of these recommendations has been implemented.
It is disappointing that those recommendations haven't been acted upon sooner.
Anne Evans used to work for the Air Accidents Investigation Branch in the UK. Back in 2009, she spent 30 days on a boat searching for the Air France Airbus.
Obviously, making a recommendation as an accident investigator, you've identified an issue and you'd like to see something change. It's just moving along that process, and sometimes it feels like that process is very slow.
How much of a spur do you think this latest accident will be in making sure that these recommendations are enacted?
I think, very tragically, this will act as a spur because it has really identified, again, what a hole we have in tracking aircraft and if something happens to them, then finding an aircraft. So my hope is that these recommendations will move quickly now and people will recognise that things need to change.
The International Civil Aviation Organisation, or ICAO, which draws up the regulations, says from 2018... the black box batteries will last for 90 days. But the other recommendations are still being discussed. We asked why the changes are taking so long, but the ICAO declined to be interviewed. It seems debates about cost and technology are part of the holdup. For relatives of the people on board the lost airliner, there is no comfort in knowing the technology exists that could have told them the fate of MH370. On Wednesday, we spoke to Bimal Sharma again. He spent the last 3.5 weeks hanging on to every scrap of information, trying to fathom what has happened to his sister Chandrika, whose 51st birthday was last Sunday.
We celebrated her birthday on the 30th, Chandrika's birthday. We lit up candles and we sang happy birthday to you and many, many more to come. And we said that I hope you come back soon.
I can't really imagine what that felt like that day, what the atmosphere was like.
Atmosphere was very positive and very vibrant, and everybody was... I mean, we were family and close friends, so all of us hoped. We still hope.
The problem is, I suppose, there will come a time eventually when they have to think about the amount of resources weighed up against the chance of finding something.
If it has crashed, that is. I still feel it's probably landed on some remote islands. So I don't know, that's what I think.
The last big aviation enigma to capture the imagination like this one was nearly 80 years ago. The American Amelia Earhart disappeared over the Pacific Ocean in 1937, trying to fly around the world. To this day, no one knows what happened, but there are plenty of theories, as there already are about the Malaysian Airlines plane. In the Indian Ocean, the search continues, using technology not even dreamt of in the 1930s, but it's possible that the fate of flight MH370 will remain another unsolved mystery. The mystery of Flight 370 was written and presented by me, Melanie Abbott. The producer was Tim Mansell.